Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Friday, the 6th of January. Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeka Kumet, in Bonn, Germany.
And Wanjiku Mwaura from the social media desk.
Coming up, Germany politicians react to a lawsuit against the German government regarding the Herero Anama filed in a U.S. court.
Deutschland hat sehr lange verweigert überhaupt von einem Völkermord an den.
For a long time, Germany refused to even speak of a genocide that had been committed against the Herero Anama, and that has resulted in anger on their side.
Russia pulls out of Syria. Is the military goal achieved? We hear from DW's correspondent in Moscow.
Well, I think it's still too early to say that Russia is properly winding down its military operations. This isn't the first time that we've heard of planned reductions in Russian forces.
We will also be reading out some of your comments on the Namibian report later.
All that and more after DW World News.
I'm Brandon Conradis with DW News. Russia announced on Friday it has begun to withdraw its military forces from Syria, more than a year after it first intervened in the war-torn country. The Kremlin said an aircraft carrier group would be the first to leave the area. The country, however, will maintain an airbase and a naval base in Syria. Moscow's decision comes in response to a ceasefire that has taken hold across much of the country. Russia intervened in the more than five-year-long war in support of embattled President Bashar al-Assad. Two ethnic groups from Namibia have sued the German government over a genocide committed over a century ago when Germans had colonized the country. The suit was filed by the Herero and Nama people in a U.S. district court in New York on Thursday. The attorney representing the Herero and Nama, Ken McCallion, said the groups must play a role in the negotiations over a settlement.
The problem is when the atrocities are closest to home, in this case, Imperial Germany, it's difficult, we understand, for Germany to come to terms with it, and we're very heartened that Germany does seem to be confronting the issue and coming to terms with it. But compensation must be an important key of the full peace, full settlement, the full resolution of the issues.
The plaintiffs accused German colonizers of suppressing the people using violence, leading to over 100,000 deaths. They also say colonizers seized land illegally and looked the other way when it came to rape. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. German Vice President Sigmar Gabriel has called for tougher measures to combat Islamist extremism in Germany amid growing pressure on politicians to respond to last month's terror attack. Gabriel told the media on Friday that hardline Islamist mosques should be banned and their leaders expelled from the country. His comments come weeks after a Tunisian migrant named Anas Amri allegedly plowed a truck into a Berlin Christmas market, killing 12 people. German authorities have come under fire over the fact that Amri was not detained sooner. But Ralf Jäger, the interior minister of the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, justified the authorities' handling of Amri.
We are living in a country governed by the rule of law, where suspicion and hearsay aren't enough to arrest someone. I believe that's the way it should be. A constitutional state must legally prove that someone has actual plans to commit a crime.
American intelligence officials reiterated this week that they had strong evidence that Russian hackers intervened to disrupt the presidential election in November. The CIA said Thursday it had identified Russian officials who fed material that had been hacked from top Democratic leaders to the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. Other top security officials released a joint statement suggesting Russia's senior-most officials authorized the attack. Tokyo announced on Friday it has recalled its ambassador to South Korea over a controversial memorial commemorating female victims of World War II. Japanese officials are angry over a statue of a so-called comfort woman erected in front of the Japanese consulate in the South Korean city of Busan. Some 200,000 South Korean women and girls were forced to become prostitutes or comfort women by Japanese forces. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Brandon Conradis.
You're listening to DW Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Jane Ayeka Kermit.
And I'm Wanjiku Mwaura.
Now, a U.S. district court in New York has become the scene of the long-standing political dispute between the German government and Namibian Herero and Nama people who are seeking reparations for a genocide campaign that was committed by German colonial troops at the start of the 20th century. Descendants of the victims on Thursday filed a lawsuit against the German government in the U.S. court. Selaoneko presents this report by Daniel Pels, who asked German politicians what they make of the lawsuit.
Between 1904 and 1908, German troops under the command of General Lothar von Trotha led the military campaign that has today been recognized as a genocide against the Herero and Nama people of Namibia. Thousands were killed, imprisoned in concentration camps, and for a long time, Germany kept some of their skulls for scientific experiments. The lawsuit that descendants of these people have now launched seeks reparations for what they call incalculable damages caused during this time. Germany's special envoy for the dialogue with Namibia, Ruprecht Polenz, told DW that he was not surprised by the lawsuit. He, however, noted that they would have a hard time convincing Germany to pay money to present-day Herero and Nama people.
Es ist aber so, dass Deutschland nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg.
The fact is that after World War II, Germany only paid personal reparations, which these are, to individuals who personally suffered in the concentration camps or were forced to do slave labor.
For years now, Germany has been in talks with the Namibian government over how to find a suitable compensation for the crimes committed. The class action suit, filed by Herero Paramount Chief Vekoi Rukoro and his Nama counterpart, David Frederick, however also demanded that the representatives must be included in the ongoing talks. German opposition MP Nima Mofasat, from Germany's Left Party, says that he understands their grievances.
Deutschland has sehr lange verweigert überhaupt von einem Völkermord an den.
For a long time, Germany refused to even speak of a genocide that had been committed against the Herero and Nama, and that has resulted in anger on their side. Now, recently, the German government has officially started calling it a genocide. That's a step forward, but Germany is still not speaking with the Herero and Nama directly. And I mean, if you speak of a genocide committed against a certain ethnic group, then it's absurd not to involve these people in the negotiations. And it's understandable that the people feel they're being taken for granted.
For the time being, Germany says the lawsuit will not affect negotiations. It also remains to be seen whether the U.S. court will have the necessary jurisdiction to deal with the case.
A report by Daniel Pels. Russia is pulling out some of its military forces from Syria, Russian General Valery Gerasimov said on Friday. The withdrawal comes 2 months after the Russian carrier vessel started operations in the conflict area. Russian forces have targeted extremist militant groups in the Syrian provinces of Idlib and Homs. I have been speaking to DW's Nicholas Conley in Moscow, and I started by asking him if this suggests that Russia has achieved its military objective in Syria.
Well, I think it's still too early to say that Russia is properly winding down its military operations. Yes, the aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov and the accompanying battle group have left Syrian waters, but they are still to be kept in battle readiness in case they're needed again. This isn't the first time that we've heard of planned reductions in Russian forces. Back in March 2016, President Putin announced the start of a pullout, and then in the end, only a few warplanes ended up withdrawing. In terms of military objectives, well, President Bashar al-Assad is still at the table, will be at the table for peace talks at the end of January. So in that sense, one objective has been achieved, but they never really clearly formulated what exactly they wanted to achieve apart from shoring up the Assad government.
This comes just a week after Russia and Turkey brokered a ceasefire that seems to be, you know, that's indicating some kind of a promise in the future of Syrian peace talks that are supposed to take off sometime later this month. What can we make out of this? In other words, what does this mean for the peace talks?
Well, this ceasefire was meant to show that Russia, along with its partners Iran and Turkey, are taking the initiative. They're taking over from the UN and the Western-backed formats, which have failed to bring results in recent months. Over the last few days, we've seen infringements of that ceasefire, and just the last few days, the Syrian National Coalition, that's the umbrella group representing the Syrian opposition group, has appealed to the UN to investigate infringements of that ceasefire, and that's really important. Russia really needs them to stay on board and to take part in these talks in Astana at the end of the month. Otherwise, it'll just be the Assad government talking to opposition groups, marginal opposition groups that it approves of. And there won't really be the sort of full breadth of opinion there, and the groups that actually decide what happens on the ground in Syria. So this is really sort of a dangerous moment now if this ceasefire fails.
Like you just indicated, Russia seems to be taking over from the UN and probably other bigger stakeholders. Is this to suggest that Russia is now the bigger and major player in Syria?
Well, yes and no. Russian intervention in Syria since September 2015 has played a crucial role in shoring up the Assad regime, which was looking very fragile at the time. Russian presence in Syria is here to stay. The Assad government has just agreed to extend the lease for Russian bases in Syria indefinitely. On the other hand, I think the Russian imprint on the ground is smaller than you'd expect. Most of their intervention has been through air power and with their navy off the shore. Iran has a lot more in the way of direct military intervention on the ground.
I was speaking to DW's Nicholas Connolly in Moscow. Now, in Ivory Coast, the defense minister has called on soldiers to remain calm and return to the barracks. His call comes after soldiers protesting over pay on Friday brought the city of Bouake and Daloa on a standstill. They attacked police stations and erected barricades on all the large roads. Gunfire surrounded Bouake in the early morning hours as soldiers took control of key positions in the city. Crispin Mwakdeo reports.
Ivorian residents said there has been intermittent gunfire since early Friday around 1 a.m. Military sources say demobilized soldiers, mainly former rebels from the decade-long conflict, broke into several police stations in the second-largest city of Bouake. They later looted weapons before taking up positions at entry points into the city. During the civil war, Bouake was the stronghold of the rebel-controlled north, and many of the fighters have been integrated into Ivory Coast's army. The soldiers, however, say not all the promises made in a 2007 agreement were implemented. A soldier who chose to remain anonymous told AFP that the mutineering soldiers were demanding 5 million CFA francs, that's $8,000 each, plus a house. Another army officer at Ivory Coast's military headquarters in the commercial capital Abidjan said reinforcements had been sent to Bouake. He, however, warned that the situation there was still unstable and that some active duty soldiers and civilians have started backing the demobilized soldiers. Shooting also broke out in the morning at Daloa, Ivory Coast's main trading hub in the Western Cocoa Belt. Witnesses also say demobilized soldiers were behind the unrest. A similar uprising occurred in 2014 when hundreds of soldiers barricaded roads in several cities and towns across the country. They, too, were demanding payment of back wages. The government agreed a financial settlement with the soldiers, who later returned to barracks.
Crispin Mwakdeo reporting. Wanjiku, tell me what's happening on social media.
Well, we'll go right to your comments on Namibia.
And what are people saying?
Well, if you're just joining us, we just ran a story on Namibia where the descendants of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the German government in a U.S. court. And Jason OGG says, just as a Holocaust, this must not be forgotten to prevent future genocides. But generating a money flow from that nowadays is wrong. Patrick Lama says, decimation of the indigenous people, their culture, language, and way of life still remains a problem today. This also, of course, raises a very interesting debate on colonization.
Yeah, that's always a very interesting topic. And I know when it comes to death and old stories, it's a very sensitive topic and people will always comment on that. I'm sure people have been commenting quite a lot.
Of course. And the conversation has evolved to bring in other people. And of particular note, other countries that benefited after the scramble of Africa. Farah Sheikh Ahmed says, we'll ask if Leopold 2 of Belgium will be sued for its inhuman act in DRC. Abibi says, truly depressing. It reminds me of Leopold 2 of Belgium and his oppression of the Africans. And the conversation is still ongoing, and we'll be having more of your comments on this and other stories. We have one last comment coming in from Annabelle Areoli, who says, the poverty of Africa is the exploitation of part of Europe for centuries. So not only Germany should pay, but all other countries that had colonies in Africa.
Very emotional comments there. We will get back to that a little later in the program. This is DW Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany, with me, Jane Ayeko Kermit.
And Wanjiko Mwaura.
Still to come, all your discussions on Facebook, social media, and sports update. But first, Wanjiko will tell us something.
Well, today on Blog Report, we will be hearing from Jamila Abdullahi, a blogger in Accra, Ghana. But what does she blog about?
We'll get to that a little later. But first, we go to Chad. The Central African country has closed its border with Libya and declared the border a zone of military operation. The move is intended to prevent terrorists from entering their country. Ziparanjeri has more.
Chad borders Libya at the north, a position which the Prime Minister Albert Pahimu Padake says has exposed its population to the risks of Islamist radical groups. Padake says some isolated terrorist groups have gathered in the south of Libya, putting the northern part of their country in danger of a terrorist infiltration. Chad is not taking any chances and has further declared the 1,000-kilometer border a military zone. Sheikh Ibn Omar, Chad's former representative to the United Nations, who is currently in exile in France, however, claims that the Chad's government is not only fearing Islamist groups, but also political opponents and rebel groups that have been able to regroup in the neighboring Libya.
Après la chute de Gaddafi, beaucoup de Chadiens...
After Gaddafi's fall, many Chadians were fighting with different militia groups in Libya. At the time, legal authorities in Libya agreed that Chadian movements regroup their fighters on Libyan territory. These were not Chadians that had come to Libya, but rather ethnic Chadians that had always lived within the confines of the country. Those fighters were regrouped on the condition of not meddling with Libyan affairs.
But the ruling party has defended its move. Secretary General of the ruling party, Mohamed Zen Bada.
We've seen press releases made by groups based outside the country. On the 2nd of January, there was one saying the time has come for the people to stand up to the regime. As the chief of the ruling political party, we will try and ensure the Republic's order on the national territory.
L'ordre républicain s'installe sur notre territoire national.
Internationally, Chad has been instrumental in the fight against radical Islamist group, among them Boko Haram, which has spread its operations from northern Nigeria to the border regions of Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. The vast desert borders of western and northern Africa are difficult to police, and terrorists can often roam between countries free and undetected. Padake is concerned about the worsening security situation in Libya, which slid into chaos after longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and killed in the 2011 uprising. The Islamic State was ousted from the Libyan city of Sirte in December, but is still thought to be present in parts of the southern of the country. Chad, a key ally of the West in the fight against Islamist militants, is supported by France and the United States, who need their cooperation to fight terrorists in the region.
Ziparanjeri reporting.
Blog Report.
And for our blog segment today, Wanjiko Mwaura has been speaking to Jamila Abdullahi from Ghana, a young lady who quit her job to pursue writing and creating content for digital platform. Her website, Circumspect, is dedicated to gender relations among young women and men and the manner in which they are socialized. Take a listen.
Looking at the finances, that was very important because this is not necessarily a paying job yet. I mean, I've had paying opportunities, thankfully, with different brands and different organizations and companies across the continent. But those, I would say, for the most part, are still one-offs. So I had to look at how I would be able to actually live while trying to put in place all of the elements of a digital business.
And are you the only content creator on Circumspect?
I would say 90% of the content is generated by me. And then what we've also started doing is getting a lot of guest contributors because Circumspect is all about perspectives. And I doubt my perspectives will be very representative of entire country, Ghana, or even the continent. So I try as much as possible to get people who are thinkers, innovators, people who have an interesting and usually unconventional approach to life or doing things to also share their views, because I think that's really what's missing for the continent, you know, a place where we can go for our own perspectives on our own issues.
Tell us more about the Lost Boy series, Misogyny and Ghana's Looming Gender Crisis.
So that's really what the Lost Boys is talking about. It's talking about the fact that we focus so much on socializing girls, especially in the African context, but we've kind of ignored socializing boys. And so what you're seeing now is girls and women are being brought up in more contemporary ways in Ghana and other African countries, but boys are still being socialized in very traditional ways. And so there's a mismatch, right? And so it ultimately affects society.
And what topics do you enjoy most writing about?
I've always been someone who has a lot of interests, so it's hard for me to pick just one. The most I can say is topics that challenge thinking or that highlight people or projects or policies that are challenging and pushing boundaries. I think that's really what I'm interested in, and that's the angle we tend to look at. Today, you have a lot of short forms. So you have Twitter, which is 140 characters. You have Facebook, which is very snappy. You have Instagram, which is photos. And yes, all of that has a place. But at the end of the day, I think as Africans, we don't have the luxury of just sticking with short form because we already have a vacuum when it comes to documenting our history and documenting what is going on. So for us, it's always a question of we focus very heavily on long form content and then bringing them all together. So something might happen on Twitter, which might be replicated on Facebook. We're going to do the article that's going to bring it all together and bring an analysis element to it so that down the line, children or grandchildren down the line are trying to figure out what was Kenya like in the year 2016. Hopefully they'll be able to see that and have a good sense of, you know, what was going on. And I think those two elements would be the things that I focus on, looking at innovation and then documentation.
Wanjiku Mwaura speaking to Jamile Abdullahi. Now, today in sports, Chuck Penfold will be talking a little bit more about the African Player of the Year and what it means for Algeria's Riyad Mahrez, who was crowned. Chuck.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a nice award, but I think it's mainly about prestige. You know, perhaps it'll make him a little more income in terms of getting endorsement contracts or things of that nature. But I think, like all these awards, including FIFA's Best or The Best, which is coming up next week, or the Ballon d'Or, this is mainly about prestige.
Like you just said, it's mainly about prestige. Does it mean that it doesn't have any significance for his English club?
I don't think it'll have that much significance for Leicester City or the Algerian national team, for that matter. Apart from maybe raising his profile somewhat, perhaps this means that Leicester could theoretically demand a slightly higher transfer fee for him at some point in the future.
Now, Dortmund's Aubameyang, who everybody was certainly expecting to take the win of the day, what happened? He only managed to come a second.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, yesterday and the hours leading up to this, of course, we discussed it. We discussed it over lunch. And everybody, to a man, was sure that Aubameyang was going to get it. I mean, he scored 25 goals last season, had 16 so far in the current campaign. The only thing I can imagine is this was voted on by African national team coaches and technical directors, members of the African media. So it was only Africa that was actually voting on this award. And maybe they see the Premier League as that much bigger a league than the Bundesliga, or perhaps they were partially seduced by that very sexy story that was Leicester winning the Premier League last year.
Maybe it's because he won last year and they didn't want him to be the one winning every now and then.
Yeah, maybe there's something to that too. But Leicester was just such a huge story last year.
Okay, let's leave it at that. And we have a little quick talk on the Africa Cup of Nations. But it appears that there's rather low enthusiasm in the host country, Gabon. They've lowered the tickets to basically lower than a dollar, but still they haven't made any big sales. What could explain this?
A couple of things I do know. I know there's a lot of poverty there, and there's been a lot of unrest in the country since the president's controversial re-election in August. I know there are people who think that instead of spending the millions to build stadiums and other costs associated with hosting the Africa Cup of Nations, they should be spending it on other things, on helping people who are in need in the country.
Jack, let's come to your area of expertise, the Bundesliga, that is still on a winter break, but coming up very soon. What can we expect as the second half resumes?
At the moment, we're watching the January transfer window. The biggest news so far has been that Wantaway young midfielder Julian Draxler has left Wolfsburg for Paris Saint-Germain. When the season does resume, we'll see if the upstarts RB Leipzig can keep up the pressure on the perennial champions Bayern.
And what's happening in Hamburg up there?
Yeah, they've just finally appointed a new sporting director, Jens Todt, who had been the sporting director at second-tier Karlsruhe. I'm not sure about this appointment. It had been rumored as far back as November. Hamburg just seemed to be in complete chaos.
I like Hamburg. They're always on relegation, but somehow they never leave the Bundesliga.
They've been very close the last, in two of the last 3 years, they had to go into the relegation playoff, but they still stayed up.
But they still stayed up,
They're still up.
That's an interesting team over there. Thank you so much, Chuck. DW Sports Editor Chuck, giving me a quick look at what is happening in the sports world. And now Wanjiku is going to take us a little more further with your comments.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to start with Africa Players Award that happened took place yesterday in Abuja, Nigeria. And the awarding ceremony was full of life and music and lots of other things. But although we do not have the time to go through the entire list of the categories that were awarded, we do have highlights. The best female player of the year was Asisat Oshoala, who was also the highest goal scorer at the 2014 FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup.
That's the Nigerian girl.
Yes, she is. And she's only 22 years old and making such big headlines.
Oh, I wish I
headlines.
Could revise the clock.
Too bad, time has passed. And the best, as you heard, the best male player of the year was Riyad Mahrez from Algeria. And there's been lots of comments regarding this.
So tell me what people say.
Simaho Simon says, congratulations, Asisat Oshoala. Well deserved. We also have another congratulations message from Ernest Namaya, who says, Asisat Oshoala, big Kongs, keep Africa, Arsenal ladies, and CAF proud.
Doesn't come as a surprise. She's been doing pretty well, yeah?
She has been. She's been incredible. And I think it was only her and two other ladies, and she has worked so hard for this recognition.
She definitely deserves it. Indeed.
We also had another category, which is the one that Dennis Onyango won. You must know Dennis Onyango. He is a team player of the Cranes, the Ugandan national team, and he was voted African Player of the Year based in Africa.
It's not so easy to find those that are based in Africa, you know. Those are people who sacrifice for the continent. I like such people.
Oh, yes, indeed, given some of the challenges that they do go through. Akila says, congratulations, Mahrez, you did it, the best African player of the year. We have engineer Manuel Nsumbuga, who says, Dennis Masinde Onyango, you became the first Ugandan to win the Africa Player of the Year. Congrats, man. Kila says, Mahrez, you did it, the best African player of the year. Riyad Mahrez himself went on to Twitter to thank his fans, and he said, I thank everyone who supported me around Africa and around the world. There are more comments on that, but now let's look at Ghana. Tomorrow will be the inauguration of their incoming president. And we have comments on this after the outgoing president, Mahama, gave his final State of the Nation address. One particular comment that stands out is Akranti Nofo, who says, Mahama's legacy is that he is the first president to tell his citizens to walk if they can't buy fuel when they complain bitterly about high fuel prices.
Interesting comments there. And those guys down in Ghana are very lucky. They had such a peaceful election and a peaceful handover. Let's wait what the new government has in offer.
Yes, indeed.
Manjiku, what else do you want to tell me as we go for the weekend? I guess you only want to wish our listeners a nice weekend, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Do have a great weekend from wherever it is you're listening to us from.
And from me, Jane Ayeka-Kumet, and the rest of the team, have a splendid weekend.
Thank you.